Chapter 9, Judges, 1991-1996. Peace officers inform me that I've been naughty. A crew of burly men entered with all the paraphernalia seen on TV, in case I was armed and dangerous. Clearly, they had done their homework and were prepared for barbed sarcasm. One of them told me to put my hands on the wall. He emptied my pockets and slapped on handcuffs. Another went directly to my freezer and liberated my blotter and a small bag of mushrooms left over from my growing days. I was in a bit of emotional shock, so I really didn't respond much at first. This was not sufficiently entertaining to one cop, who started regaling me with stories of how the English used to torture and execute felons like me, in rather graphic and gory detail, trying to get me all scared, and thus get his rocks off. But I just sat there. I gave them a tour of my place, including my dome and Oracle Project trailer, trying valiantly to explain how this was an attempt to interact with other planes. A photographer from the Salisbury Post took photographs of the odd contraption. I also explained my music composition, but they had long ago decided I must be insane, so attempts to communicate were difficult. I took a paperback copy of the Bhagavad Gita as my sole possession and had a last glance at my beloved cat on the way to the caged back seat. When we arrived at the Salisbury jail, Sergeant Don Gale of the State Bureau of Investigation brought me to see Sheriff Bob Martin, then in his mid-70s. Later, his photograph would grace the Salisbury Post, showing him holding a page of my blotter with plastic gloves under the headline, "Largest haul ever of LSD is seized." Largest for our county, at least. Typical of the Post to use the passive voice for such an aggressive action. The police got 10,483 doses, which they had ordered, and an ounce of mushrooms. As usual, they grossly exaggerated the worth, saying that the blotter, which cost me $5,000, was worth $52,000, and the ounce of mushrooms was worth $6,500, about 40 times too much. They also claimed that I had bought 80,000 hits in the last 6 months, which was 50,000 past reality. I next went to a small office where an old clerk in a severe crew cut decided my bail should be $500,000. As I entered the jail, I turned and saw a magnificent sunset, almost as if it were made to order. I tried to soak in the beauty for as long as possible. I would not see another sunset for 2 years. My first stop was to Don Gale's office. He was having a great time, and with some delight, told me the details of the charges against me. Psychedelics, and LSD in particular, are weighed including whatever substrate holds them, which typically will be far more massive than the drug itself. Thus, one hit in a glass of water would count as millions of hits. This allows the state to charge offenders with whatever they like. For 1,000 doses and above, the penalty is a minimum mandatory 35 years plus $200,000 fine. There was also an indictment of 12 years for the little bag of mushrooms that they would leave hanging until after Carla was sentenced. The only way I would ever get out of prison would be to cooperate and hope they reduced the charges. There were two judges taking six-month turns at the Rowan County Courthouse. One was extremely severe and would never let me out, while the other might be more reasonable. Thus, I had to try and time my trial for the lesser of two evils. The law is like that. Then he took me to the accountant's office to learn about the stamp tax. A young woman there was enjoying her job, racking up the bills against all the bad people out there. There was a charge of $40 per hit, which doubled if not paid within a few days, and then accumulated interest. The debt would evaporate mysteriously in 10 years, but by the time it did, I was over $1 million in debt. All my possessions would be taken immediately without any due process and auctioned off, and all my money would be seized. This was quite popular with the public, since they got stuff cheap, and, of course, the cops could take whatever they liked home as well. Our legal system is a commercial cash-and-carry operation optimized for profit. Not having any money meant I had to be content with the court-appointed lawyer, Marshall Bickett. He was a mild-mannered man of low intellect, well-suited to the job of making my prosecution easy, which is why he got lots of work. Now, in 2011, he is district court judge and is running for superior court. Most inmates with appointed lawyers see them only at booking and at trial, with little or no contact otherwise, even if waiting months or years. As I had friends to intervene, I fared a little better, but I had to prepare to wait weeks or months for responses to my letters. He felt free to tell me lies if they were convenient. Finally, I changed from street clothes to the rags that inmates wore, which were washed once a week, and was led to my cell block. Up to now, I had kept a fairly even emotional state. For many years, I'd considered myself a pretty good yogi. And after the arrest, I had my mantra going, watching the drama go past in a witness awareness the way you're supposed to do. But when I heard the door clang shut behind me, I realized I wasn't as good at the yoga thing as I thought. Even after so many years, my practice had been unfocused and haphazard. Far from being free from attachment, I was attached to every tiny detail of my life, all of which was now violently wrenched away. After all the daring things I'd done over the years, the universe conspired to deal up a situation where I had no bravery at all. It finally registered that today could be the first day of the rest of my life, and the prospect was terrifying. But they would have done much worse given the chance. Sue Myrick, mayor of Charlotte, and later a representative in Congress, said they should build concentration camps for drug dealers. In fact, the jail I now sat in was a few hundred yards from the site of a Civil War POW camp where thousands of Yankee prisoners starved to death. My first impression was that this felt just like public school, which I last experienced in the 7th grade. These were the students who majored in detention, and now they were professionals. I could just barely get into the top bunk, which was the only vacancy. My health would decline rapidly, and soon this would be impossible. While lying on the bed and trying to relax, I was hit with what felt like a massive electric shock that threw me into the air about 6 inches. After a sleepless night, I was exhausted and stared through the bars for hours. Frequently, I would sob uncontrollably, which did not help my social standing. One black inmate, fresh from the street, wanted me to read him his indictment. I said that he was charged with premeditated murder with malice aforethought. Then I had to explain to him what premeditated, malice, and aforethought meant. He showed no sign of any emotion whatsoever. I could just as easily be reading him a menu at a restaurant. His bail was $50,000, one-tenth of mine. The case was not important enough to be in the newspapers. In his part of town, people were expected to kill each other. It was no big deal. The average time served in prison for homicide was 8 years. Don Gale and Lieutenant Wood fetched me, and we drove back to my home. Diane Corlett joined us. She was incredibly helpful and patient, taking time out of her many pastoral duties to help me in my time of greatest need. There were many small, obnoxious details, and my family was far too removed to help. Diane condemned my actions, but helped out anyway. Gale and Wood took my money from the bank, some $10,635, most of which was from the two transactions with Big Bob's mysterious customer. I signed over all my possessions, and various officers started loading things up. They asked me how to sell my music. I told them I'd been trying to sell it for 19 years with no luck. So they dumped the folders of camera-ready scores onto the floor and took the filing cabinets to auction. Someone tore apart the Oracle, stealing the crystal and whatever parts had value, such as the gold wire on the antenna in the Oregon box. I told them that my landlord owned the piano in hopes of saving it. My violins went off to Mom and Burns, since much of that they owned. The cops took my diaries and several books as evidence, including the well-researched and accurate Acid Dreams, the complete social history of LSD, which covered the role of the CIA in some detail. Never saw that book again. Soon after, the landlord from the trailer next door surveyed what was left. He saw the pile of music folders on the floor, and having no clue what written music was, figured it was trash. He put it in garbage bags and hauled it to the dump. Friends saw him doing this, but did nothing to stop him, not wanting to get involved. Thus, 19 years of work was now landfill. Later, this landlord couldn't make payments and drove off with the now empty camping trailer once used for the Oracle. My original landlady rented out the house, offering to give my friends my upright piano in exchange for someone dismantling the dome. Gary offered to do this, but he has difficulties getting things done and put it off for several months. Before he could get around to it, the next tenant sold my piano and kept the cash. Don told me, "You made your bed, and now you must sleep in it." That way, all the cruel things they enjoyed doing to me was my fault. I did not recall passing or supporting any of the absurd laws that I violated, nor had I helped construct any penal institutions, much less the bunks and mattresses. In fact, Gerald Blow took a photograph of me voting against Jesse Helms. I did what I could to unmake the bed. Now I was the raw material of the law industry. Diane Corlett saw to it I had $20 and a $5 book of stamps so that I could write my friends and family with the bad news. When back in my cell block, I needed a shower and put the money in my shirt pocket. When I got out of the shower, the money and the stamps were gone. I was now cut off from writing to friends and family. Inmates smirked at my stupidity. Clearly, I needed to figure out how things worked in this domain of the damned. It's much like the outer world, only more so, and with immediate consequences. Deciphering the inmate code. Item: the strong are admired for dominating the weak. The only admissible means of defense are violence or the threat of violence. relying on officers for protection is strictly forbidden and severely punished. Being a witness or reporting a crime, even when it is done to you, means you are a snitch, which is a word only used by people in a thoroughly criminalized culture. Item: race matters, and you can't enjoy the middle-class luxury of forgetting about it. Everyone will disapprove if a white person acts black or a black person acts white. White inmates watch NASCAR. Blacks watch basketball. Everyone watches crime shows, and no one watches The Simpsons. Item: there are some behavior patterns among the black inmates that are part of the normal culture of prison. If one shakes his fist at you, this is friendly. He means no harm. He will likely ask in every other sentence if you know what he's saying, but you don't need to reassure him that you do indeed comprehend his meaning. The word motherfucker doesn't actually signify anything and will be used in every sentence, sometimes multiple times, in every conceivable grammatical role. It exists only to ensure the crudity of expression and prevent gainful employment. Normal behavior includes walking about with one hand in the pants holding his penis or having the pants riding a foot low. Anthropologists remain baffled. Item: suffering is entertainment. When two inmates fight, they are immediately surrounded by a circle of cheering and laughing cellmates having a wonderful time. When an inmate takes medicine from others, mixes them together, and swallows them, resulting in seizures, this is a source of great hilarity. Compassion is a sign of weakness. Item: respect for the disreputable is mandatory. The more disreputable the person, the more mandatory the respect. The entire world is constantly telling inmates that they are worthless and hated. Respect is the closest acceptable substitute for love and costs nothing to give. Don't expect any back. Item: crimes do much to determine social rank. This was greatly to my benefit. Child molesters are at the bottom, of course, along with those who prey upon helpless people like the elderly. Drug chemists are at the very top, along with cop killers. Since I spoke in complete sentences, they assumed I was a chemist. Denial was completely ineffective, so I stopped correcting them. Item: the large majority of inmates are, or have been, addicted to something. 90% smoke the most deadly drug, tobacco, and about a third will die from smoking. When tobacco is forbidden behind bars, inmates will pay up to $200 for a pack of cigarettes. The fact that drugs are available in prison proves that controlling them with laws is hopeless. Very few inmates have any interest in psychedelics like psilocybin or LSD. For those that do, they are just one of the list of drugs they abuse. Involvement with any kind of drug in prison is extremely dangerous. Item: sex is only about lust and power and has little or no relationship to love at all. The code concerning sex was too depressing and confusing for me to figure out. My efforts went into avoiding being someone's punk. This was one environment when being undesirable was a distinct advantage. Item: everyone lies, but only prisoners pay a price for lying. As a result, employees of the justice system systematically deceive inmates. Seeing this gives inmates no particular motivation to see the justice system as a moral institution or any reason to become more truthful themselves. I go to the loony bin and back. Crowding was intense. At one point, I was sleeping near the shower on the floor under a bunk bed, trying to avoid splashes of water and the occasional rat. Bickett got me a single cell due to my health. The food was abominable and almost inedible. There had been a retired couple who cooked good food for the inmates, but one day they were murdered in a home invasion, or so I heard, and their replacement had no clue. My iritis flared up from the stress, and I needed cortisone eye drops every 2 hours. This irritated the staff, since they had to fetch the medicine and watch me take the drops, and frequently I went quite some time without. Jail is not meant for either disabled inmates or for long-term residents, and I was very likely going to have many months before trial. If Diane and I could convince officials that I might be needing a test for mental competency, I could get a break at Dorothea Dix Hospital in Raleigh for a few weeks. 4 days after my arrest, the Salisbury Post ran an article saying I was trying to send my music to outer space, with pictures of the Oracle and lurid misinformation. This convinced many that I was, as they call it, a bug. I had my ticket to Dix 3 days later. Competence to stand trial basically means you can say your name and what year it is, and damn few inmates fail the test. Those that do are locked in the hospital until treatment succeeds in making them competent, after which they go to trial. I just wanted to get out of jail and eat some decent food with no urine on the floor, so off I went. The food was great, and the nursing staff actually cared about our health. Of course, they thought I was a horrible felon who should never get out, but I was used to that by now. Inmates here could have cigarettes, unlike in jail, so I gagged on the smoke most of the day. There was the occasional psychotic break from one or another of my comrades, but there were several orderlies around that were selected for brawn. There was an opportunity to catch up on correspondence. Mom sent me a letter saying I was a fun little boy until drugs got hold of me, and society was right to lock me up in a very unpleasant place. My recollection was that I was a neurotic and unhappy little boy until I started having a spiritual life. Another person very close to me said, "Don't do the crime if you can't do the time," neglecting to recall his years growing 14-foot marijuana plants. Many others ran away for reasons of their own. Eventually, my list of friends shrank to those who were loyal and genuine. Susan and Ray Davies took in my cat soon after my arrest and kept her in their home. They had quite a few animals outside, including some cats, a couple of dogs, and a goat. Mauser was not used to nice furniture and, while affectionate, messed up the place. So Susan had to put her outside with the other animals. She freaked out, ran off in the woods, and died. About a year later, she visited on whatever plane it is that such things happen, and said that she now lived with Leonard Bernstein, who had several dogs as well. "I don't make the news, I just reports it. Hey, Lenny, be good to my cat." I stretched my stay to 3.5 weeks, which was as much as possible, after which the doctor wrote a single sentence saying I was, in fact, perfectly sane, free from mental defect or deficiency, and fit to punish. Your tax dollars at work. Back to jail I went. My single cell was between two black juveniles who were good friends, both 15 years old. One was facing a 40-year charge for statutory rape. His mother had set him up on a date with a 13-year-old girl. Her mother got wind of it afterwards and pressed charges. I don't know what the other one was in for, but he amused himself by threatening to kill me and yelling over to the women's section about sex acts. They both talked endlessly about Judy Fly, which I eventually found out was a nickname for joints laced with crack. Single cells also functioned as the drunk tank, so most evenings we were joined by men out of their minds on alcohol. I learned to keep my few books and documents under my mattress and off the floor, since drunks would frequently urinate into the hallway or use a cup to empty their toilet and flood nearby cells. It's against the law to mix adults and juveniles, but the jail was both condemned and extremely overcrowded and didn't bother with all the rules. We had to go to a cell block normally holding 16 inmates for some time during the day to get our showers and mandatory time out of our single cells. This meant combining the age groups, which was very dangerous for the adults. One homeless man had been in jail for 3 weeks for being hungry and stealing a hot dog. A white 15-year-old beat him badly and broke his nose. Treating him would cost money, not to mention bring attention and possibly a lawsuit. The folks running the place decided to drop the hot dog charge and let him go, bloody shirt, broken nose, and all. I was hoping to keep my SSI income, but the rules say that if a beneficiary spends one night in any institution that provides room and board, such as a nursing home, mental hospital, or jail, then the SSI benefits are terminated. Restoring benefits can take years, during which the disabled person has only food stamps and, if lucky, Medicaid. I could not reapply until release. Diane helped me get some letters out to my friends, and I was in contact with Mom. This was extremely helpful. I got a copy of the infamous Salisbury Post article and wrote short notes to a list of friends. Then I sent the lot to Jim McGuire so that he could copy the article and send out the letters. This would be invaluable, and I couldn't manage it from my cell. However, Jim thought for some reason that he would deliberately make my situation more difficult. So he did nothing with the letters and didn't tell me he didn't send them. For the next 6 months, when I sent letters to friends, they were shocked that I was in prison, until finally Jim told me what he'd done. But I did have a great advantage over most inmates, and that quite a few friends were helping as best they could. Ray Davies and others from Cleveland went to my home and salvaged what they could of the Oracle and other odds and ends. Way Wired Willie and Alice helped compile a list of items to be auctioned, and Mom and other friends helped get some cash together to try and buy back the basic necessities. Diane visited several times and was the main reason I ever saw my lawyer at all, although he would rather have ignored me and just picked up the check. I was not the easiest person to help. Despite meditation and all the spiritual practice I could manage, my nerves were shot. I was not in control of my emotions, and when writing to friends, they would misinterpret what I was saying as ingratitude to them. I kept copies of all my outgoing letters, and it's clear that my mental state was in turmoil and despair until after my trial. It was just too much for me to handle. Diane gave me a copy of the Episcopal Book of Common Prayer, which was a stretch for me, but a welcome addition to my small but growing library. I was used to prayers chanted by naked sadhus covered in buffalo dung ash with waist-long dreadlocks on the banks of the Ganges, while these were prayers recited by lawyers and stockbrokers on the banks of the Thames. She also sent books by St. John of the Cross and St. Teresa of Avila. Spiritual practice filled as many hours of the day as possible. Every night before bed, I would read a chapter of the Gita. I needed chanting beads, and Diane tried sending me rosaries several times over the next year, but none got through. It's hard to imagine that a rosary sent from a priest well known to the authorities would be considered dangerous contraband. But that's the mentality of the prison world. Susan came to visit once at the jail. All visits were through glass. Her friendship and affection were lifesavers for me. It was so wonderful to see her, but wrenching, and I broke down during the whole time we spoke together. I told her of a vision I'd had the night before, which I don't usually do since it sounds so terribly odd. Unfortunately, one of the two juvenile crackheads was within listening distance and tormented me later with what he'd heard. Some inmates saw that I was interested in meditation and Hinduism and said they'd been in the Charlotte jail when Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh was there in 1985. He was fleeing prosecution for a multitude of crimes, flying from his commune in Oregon to the Bahamas in a rented Learjet when he was arrested at a North Carolina airstrip while refueling. While in the Mecklenburg County Jail for a few days, he taught meditation to inmates and was very popular. He asked the jailers for ice cream, but they laughed at him. They said if he had ice cream, then everyone would have to have ice cream. Fair enough, he responded, and bought a local creamery to supply the whole jail. To this day, they serve ice cream 3 times a week, or so the inmates said. For the entire time before trial, I tried to get an estimate of how severe my punishment would be. It was not in the interest of the state for me to know, so my lawyer and all the officials I talked to said they didn't know the rules for parole or how much I would be charged with. Nor did they indicate how much an effect my cooperation would have. The usual way was for an inmate to earn a day off his sentence for every day of good behavior, and he'd be eligible for parole after 1/8 of the remaining time served. This would be a great deal if I got a sentence of 14 years, as I would be paroled probably after a couple of years total time. As a result, I was very optimistic about getting out before very long. Not a single person, in or out of the system, gave me the true facts. Everyone who knew lied to me. Don Gale interviewed me several times to get information about those I had done business with. While I had to cooperate in order to not die in prison, I was ill-disposed to inform on those good friends who had done not only nothing wrong, but in my view had performed a valuable service to thousands of people, who frequently expressed their gratitude. There were associates along the way who were not honest and who took advantage of me, and I felt that they had forfeited any expectation that I would sacrifice years or decades of my life on their behalf. Thankfully, later when I checked with my friends, there were no arrests or hassles as a result of what I said, even to those who had stolen from me. Carla's address was on the envelopes, so they had all they needed on her already. The California narcs raided her houseboat, but she wasn't there. Although they searched the boat and found acid, the court threw out the charges because she wasn't home, and so the warrant wasn't properly executed or some such detail. Now she could only be brought up on federal charges. The feds told Don Gale that they had no interest in me, since they considered LSD to be a kiddie drug. But with Carla, they did pay attention, and over the next 2 years brought a case against her. Eventually, she got a 7-year sentence, which would mean 6 years served. I wrote her after she was in prison, but never heard back. One day in the cell block, I met a young fellow who had been found in a groggy state on his porch, covered in blood. Someone had carved X marks all over his chest with a knife. A doctor sewed them up with what must have been a few hundred stitches. But our patient was bored with all that thread and started picking them off. We told him he would be scarred for life if he did that, but he didn't care. It was fun to pick the threads. There was a heavily muscled, quiet white guy who never wore a shirt. He didn't need to, as his entire chest, back, and arms were covered with tattoos. On closer inspection, beyond the usual swastikas and knives, I saw that the picture covering his back depicted a lynching. The black inmates gave him a wide berth, which for me meant his company was the safest place in the jail. Any port in a storm. Mr. Big goes to Central Prison. Rowan County was getting frustrated with my medical care, minimal as it was. Don Gale wanted to have me available to testify at Carla's trial, but who knew when that might be? Also, I had to wait for the right judge. Jail is not designed for long-term stays. It is deliberately stressful to intimidate those held before trial and give them motivation to transition quickly to prison. This is a successful and economical strategy, since cruelty is cheap. At the end of September, they shipped me off to Raleigh once again, this time to be a maximum security guest at Central Prison. At Central, I was what they call a safekeeper. This was for inmates who were awaiting trial and needed either medical attention or protection from assault, or if they were very dangerous. Many safekeepers had been on death row and were here to prepare for a new trial or hearing. The cell blocks were interchangeable with those used by death row inmates, and the restrictions were in some ways more severe. We could not visit the canteen, chapel, or the library, but we did have limited ability to borrow books and buy snacks. Otherwise, the only real difference was that death row wore red jumpsuits and we wore yellow. General population wore gray. Any contact was potentially dangerous, since the assumption was that safekeepers were snitches. Once a week, at 7 a.m, we had an hour of recreation in a small cement yard with 40-foot walls and a gun tower. But we had no warm clothes, so for much of the year, it was far too cold for me to go outside at all. We had 1 10-minute collect phone call a year at Christmas. The cell block was overcrowded, so they put up bunk beds in the day room. Newcomers started there, then went to single cells as they became available. There were no lockers, and thus no way to secure possessions against theft. I was very eager to get a single cell, but to get a better place in line would cost me $10. At the moment, I had no money. No one wanted my books and papers, but here at Central, once I could afford it, I could have a small radio with earplugs, which would have to be defended. It was very difficult to sleep on a bunk bed from the combination of noise in the room and motion from the guy on the upper bunk. The TV was cranked up all day until 11 p.m. Thankfully, I was allowed earplugs, which were forbidden in jail. For the rest of my time in prison, getting fresh earplugs was a major preoccupation and priority. My first earplugs came from a mild-mannered biker named Danny. He was charged with killing three drunks with his bare hands in an altercation outside a bar. That's what happens when you know karate. Danny brewed some hooch from fermenting fruit he got at Chow. I think he got drunk from the placebo effect. Officers were usually absent from the cell block. They came in during the several counts each day, banging the few window bars with a stick to see if they'd been partially sawn. Except for that, we were watched from behind bulletproof glass by an officer in a console with switches controlling the doors and lights. He could listen through hidden microphones to most things discussed in the day room. I saw the lieutenant in his office call down to the officer in the console when he needed to know what was up. Snitches were hardly necessary. All the doors were electrically controlled. The single-cell doors could be opened all at once or individually, but only from the console. Between our cell block and the hallway was a double door, with just enough room between for all of us to pack in. One of those two doors was always closed. The dining hall was quite some distance away through a long tunnel. Between my cell and the dining hall were 12 doors, all controlled from behind glass. Meals were particularly dangerous, since all the safekeeping cell blocks were mixed together and we could pass by inmates from general population in the hall. I had an opportunity to go completely vegetarian, but this would mean 2 peanut butter meals a day. Instead, I did as the Muslim inmates and ate red meat for the rest of my years in prison. I didn't have to eat pork. This was a very different environment than either the Salisbury Jail or Dorothea Dix. In jail, most were in for minor charges, and many would never go to prison at all. As a result, there was no interest among other inmates in anything spiritual. Here, it was very different. Almost all the inmates were facing serious time, and many would never leave prison. The level of despair was palpable. This was the bottom of the bottom, and it was enough to reach some very hardened souls. We had a prayer circle that met every evening in our cell block, led by a young black inmate down from New York. He was a very friendly and upbeat guy, very easy to like and intelligent, and deeply devoted to Jesus. I couldn't imagine why he was here. He had a good office job, and things seemed to be going well for him. I think he was charged with murder, but can't be sure. Puzzled the heck out of me. Something like half of the cell block was in the prayer circle. You don't get that kind of intensity in your normal corner church. On the other end of the spectrum, soon after my arrival at Central, some inmates came to me asking me to lead them in a black mass, since they saw I was interested in meditation and such. Preachers told them that yoga, Hinduism, and LSD were demonic, so how about it? Another time, two cellmates needed me as a third party for a seance where they'd sell their souls to the devil in exchange for freedom. I don't think they'd done the math on that one. Veterans were well represented. One served in World War II. Another had been in Korea. He was overly fond of bombs and had many arrests for owning and using high explosives. He was caught blowing up fish in a local lake. The authorities lost patience and brought him to Central. I asked him why he didn't just use a rod and reel, and he looked at me like I was crazy. "Because I like dynamite," he said with a leering grin. His hands had been shaking for the 40 years since the Korean War. I think he'd done bumped his head. Another soldier was from the first Gulf War, which had ended just months before. When he came back from action, he raped and killed a 5-year-old girl and left her body on a hill. He was not particularly worried, as he was convinced that no jury would convict him, since he was a veteran. We spent a bundle teaching these guys to kill without remorse, and did nothing to deprogram them on return. The training is a substantial investment, and we might need them to kill again someday. What do we expect? One of the first people I'd phoned after arrest was Anshul Brusilov. His son was a lawyer, and Anshul thought he might be able to help. He talked with Dad and sent some encouraging letters, which I really needed then. The best I could hope for with many people who meant a lot to me was that they would say I did something really terrible, and now that I realized how bad it was, I could reform my behavior and everything would be better someday. I learned to say that I was overcome with remorse and that I had made a horrible mistake by being involved with psychedelics, or many people would abandon me and the punishment would never stop. Once out of prison, I could speak my mind, but this was just not possible behind bars, where I was at the mercy of people who were good, righteous, and moral, and thus capable of unlimited cruelty. So I was forced to tell people I'd seen the error of my ways. Groveling is cheap. One of my friends on the block was an extremely tall and slender black man named, oddly enough, Slim. I wrote his letters for him, and so got to know the details of his life. He managed to be upbeat and could put a bright edge on a bleak day. Every male member of his family was in prison. His letters to his girlfriend were wrenching, as he didn't know the names of his own twin infants. He was going to give testimony in a trial so that he would someday be released, and as a result, one day, he was badly beaten. But he told the doctor who bandaged his ribs that he'd fallen down the stairs. Otherwise, he'd have to be locked down in protective custody. One day, an inmate named Camacho charged at him in the day room and threatened to cut his throat with a razor, but this was averted at the last minute. Camacho was a Mexican who pretended to be Japanese and wore a samurai headband to look the part. Soon after, Camacho went to trial, where he was defending himself for 2 capital murder charges. He'd killed an ex-girlfriend and her new boyfriend with a hammer. He got the death penalty, much to the amusement of the guards, who gave a candid assessment of his legal skills. They didn't like him much after he threw water mixed with Bengay in a guard's face. His cell was now empty, and after a week in the day room, I moved in. I was more concerned about getting his room than his living on death row. Life is like that. Dad sent $1,000, which he could ill afford, and others pitched in as best they could in preparation for the auction. As a result, I could get my radio, which was fixed to my ears most of the day for the duration. Dad also got me membership in a book club, and I started a considerable library. I needed my own supply. One of the cells in our block was full of books and magazines accumulated over a few years, as well as board games. But a few months later, an illiterate inmate decided that if he couldn't read, no one else should be able to, and he threw the books away and tore up the games. We salvaged some, but most were lost. Several black inmates thought that saving the garbage bags full of books was cooperating with the man, whoever that might be. Since most of the people who wanted to read were white, this caused considerable racial tension for a couple of days. I know it makes no sense, but there it is. I was very depressed and went to see the psychiatrist. She was a Hindu woman dressed in a sari with a bindu on her forehead, and I thought maybe I could communicate with her. No such luck. After I tried to explain my situation, she cut me off and said that her job was to find which medication I should use and at what dosage. She didn't have time to talk about problems. If I wasn't happy here in the bowels of hell, then there must be some chemical imbalance in my brain that could be fixed with a combination of pills that would flatten my emotions, remove access to transcendental states, and make me not bother her any more. "Trust the pills," she said soothingly. "They're good for you." I figured there must be a chemical balance in her brain that could be undone with a combination of my own pills, if I could just get them back from the evidence locker. Then maybe she could talk to me as one soul to another. I tried flirting with low doses of her tranquilizers and antidepressants, but they were of little use. Later, she gave me an antipsychotic that put me on a horrifying bummer for 2 days. No more of her meds for me. They were by far the most dangerous drugs I'd ever done. I know they're useful for people with mental illnesses who are having visions and hearing voices and need to shut that stuff down. Drugs that reinforced the mechanistic view of reality were big money earners and pillars of the medical establishment. Psychedelics did not function that way and could never be part of the pharmacopoeia. In mid-October, they executed a guy from the cell block across the hall. When that happens, the whole prison locks down and everything is very tense for a couple of days, with the occasional burning mattress and threats of riots. Thankfully, this was the only execution while I was at Central. Diane was involved in a group protesting the death penalty. I had mixed feelings, since I was dealing with inmates who had killed or raped other prisoners. They were already in for life, and some time in segregation was not a big deal for them. If there was no death penalty, then there really wasn't any punishment they would consider as deterrent, which increased the threat level for people like me, as well as anyone who worked in the prison. The furniture in the day room was all welded stainless steel, very hard for me to sit on and quite loud when used as percussion. Rap expressed the heart and diseased soul of the gangster mentality. Inmates who never learned to read or add or subtract could recite from memory complex lyrics for half an hour at a time. The metal tables used as drums added to the din. Although most of the words were incomprehensible, what I could make out glorified hatred, murder, rape, greed, and addiction. This is most profitable for the music industry that pushes the poison all over the planet. It's not surprising that artists for Death Row Records shoot each other. This doesn't tend to happen with the Juilliard String Quartet, although from time to time, they probably ponder such things in the dark recesses of their classical hearts. If there ever were to be hope for rehabilitation in prison, the first thing they would have to change is the soundtrack. One of the most dangerous inmates I met in prison was a huge black man named Rayford Burks. Rayford determined what was on the TV, and any disagreement led quickly to a beating. I managed to get along with him pretty well, but it was a real challenge. He'd previously killed about 5 people and gotten away with it, since prosecutors couldn't get anyone to testify. Now he was going to be tried for a 1990 murder where there was a witness who would take the stand. He went to trial in late 1991, and despite the witness, got off. He could intimidate any black person on the jury. Once on the street, he stabbed a man and shot his girlfriend, both non-fatally. 2 months after the trial, at a crack house in Statesville, after having given threats, he shot and killed the man who testified against him. When he was tried for this murder, the prosecutors managed to get an all-white jury. His family sat in the back of the courtroom, glaring at the jury. Although they couldn't sleep at night, jurors refused to cave in to the pressure. Three crackheads testified, and Burks was finally convicted and sent to death row. A group called Death Watch is now trying to get him released, claiming this was all a terrible miscarriage of justice. If they succeed, order more body bags. Thankfully, they have no chance. In October, Anton flew to Boston for a few days, then back to Jakarta. He and Doc Humes advised that I stand up to the law, plead an insanity defense, and claim the statute was unconstitutional. This would guarantee life behind bars, but I would be making a noble stand. I said, no thanks. When arrested, I had long hair and a month-old beard. Finally, here in Central Prison, I cut the hair and shaved. The beard would come and go, but my hair stayed short from then on. The longest hair I saw in prison was worn by a very private and polite white inmate a couple doors down from me. His hair went down almost to his waist. He only came out of his cell when he had to, which tended to be my routine as well. After a few months, I finally got to talk to him, enough to learn some of his story. He'd originally been in maximum security in Iowa, where he resisted everything and ended up in the basement of a formidable prison in solitary. Guards fed him food through a hatch in the door, dressed in protective gear, and mostly he'd thrown it right back at them. After some time, his sentence expired, and they had to let him go. He moved to the mountains of North Carolina. A couple of friends asked for his advice on a burglary, and he told them how it should be done. The two friends invaded a trailer, killed the couple inside, and set the place on fire. My long-haired friend went to trial while I was at Central, and I last saw him in gray clothes in general population, smiling and waving. He got 108 years, which for Hindus is an auspicious number. Not for him. In November, I got two books from Human Kindness Foundation. This was originated by Ram Dass in the 1970s to help prisoners have access to yogic materials behind bars, but was quickly handed over to Bo and Sita Lozoff. Now they were headquartered in Durham, soon to move to a nearby rural property. Bo's book, We're All Doing Time, is well known in prisons all over the country and is quite helpful. Most importantly, it helped focus my spiritual practice and reminded me of Neem Karoli Baba, the guru that Ram Dass found in India. He started showing up in my meditations and in time became my main guide. Bo was on a verbal fast, not talking or writing to anyone for 3 years, but I corresponded with Sita. The cops told me they would notify me in advance of my auction, but that was another lie to keep me off balance. My friends heard of it through the papers and managed to attend at short notice on Friday, December 13th. Gary Weinreb, Diane, Susan, and Ray rewired Willie and Alice, and Jim McGuire attended. Thankfully, my klepper and most of my kayak sailing gear was in bags, so no one knew what it was. Both the klepper and my single were saved, along with some basic goods that would be waiting for me on release. I learned about it after the fact. The unrelenting harshness of the environment forced me to realize the lack of loving relationships in my life. I went many years without ever using a term of endearment to another person. Now the yearning for anything feminine, anything warm, soothing, comforting, nurturing, accepting, and affectionate ate at my mind. Some of that translated into uncontrollable lust, which was a disaster and probably the most difficult and painful aspect of the whole prison experience. Before arrest, I thought I had that under control, but this was simply a matter of distraction and avoidance, not spiritual progress. Meanwhile, I had to deal with a psychotic black inmate who enjoyed sexually assaulting weaker whites. I saw him do this to another who managed to fend him off. Now he had me as his target. When he shoved me around and grabbed at me, all the other blacks in the cell block, including people I considered friends, jeered at me and cheered him on. I had no allies to protect me. A friend of the aggressive inmate tried to sell me protection with lurid stories about breaking my jaw, but I refused. Then they forcibly stole my radio. Someone told the guards, and they were both locked down. Black inmates got in the habit of slipping lit cigarettes into my back pockets, but at least I wasn't beaten or raped. At the same time, I got a letter from Jim saying the usual New Age crap about how everything was just as it should be, that I created all these experiences, and how it was all a setup. He said he was tired of my victim trip and so forth. A lot of my friends said this kind of thing. I got a feel for what combat veterans go through when coming back to a country that has not experienced war on its soil for over 100 years. My friends, however well-meaning, simply had no idea what I was going through. Eventually, I gave up trying to talk about what it was like and saved it for my eventual book. It won't work there either, but what the heck? Before Christmas, inmates can receive food from the outside, and this was a real treat. Still, Christmas and Thanksgiving were the most difficult times to be a prisoner, as they have always been for me anyway. I borrowed families on the outside, but couldn't do that here. I did my best to love the ones I was with. 1992 starts with cosmic income. Mom was notified in December about a man who had stayed with her family in the late 1930s as a teenager and had lived in and out of mental institutions since. He had been entirely out of contact and forgotten by Mom and her family. He died in 1990 and, completely out of the blue, left John, Akonda, and me $2,000 each. We'd never heard of the guy, but the timing was superb. After various legal hurdles, this meant I would be able to pay back many of the people who had contributed to my auction. This left a few hundred to live on for the duration. Anton wrote from his 4,000-square-foot apartment with 30-foot ceilings in Singapore that his Chinese friends paid $4 million for an ancient map pinpointing the fabled City of Gold in the Gobi Desert. They got permission from the Chinese government to excavate and share findings. He still owed me $350. Anton had joined the Royal Sovereign Military and Hospitaller Order of St. John of Jerusalem, Knights of Malta Ecumenical. They claimed territorial sovereignty over the uninhabited Spratly Islands off the coast of Vietnam, thus making them a government. The Chinese, Taiwanese, Vietnamese, Malaysian, and Philippine governments would beg to differ on this point. The Knights were interested in setting up shop in Annobon, an island off the coast of West Africa. This would involve a deal with Equatorial Guinea's vicious and violent dictator Obiang, who, according to Anton, had depopulated the island by imprisoning 130,000 of the former residents on the mainland. The Knights didn't care about details involving the impoverished and oppressed rabble, and made Obiang a knight himself. If this succeeded, then I'd have a location and funding for the Oracle, and a commission to write the national anthem. I suppose O Tannenbaum could be changed to O Annabon without too much labor. His sister Rose was now visiting India with the Radha Swami folks, having satsang with Gurinder Singh. That's the kind of thing I would be doing if I could. Chasing gurus sound more attractive than chasing imaginary gold. My physical health steadily declined after a rest, and in February I had to ask for a cane, since my artificial left hip hurt. I have had to use a cane ever since. The prison doctor, who was an orthopedic surgeon, took x-rays of my various innards. He opined that I really should be executed for trafficking LSD, and by the way, he could give me a new hip. I'd never had a doctor who thought I should be killed. It was not exactly comforting to think of him cutting me open some day. But then he'd heard the same strange propaganda as everyone else, and I'm sure he'd not read the scholarly literature. On the TV news, the reporters said there was an increase in LSD use around the state. For their expert on the subject, they interviewed the head of the State Bureau of Investigation. He held up some of my acid and said that this deadly drug was being marketed to young children. Cue the weird color effects. Their only evidence for this was that the acid was very cheap. They didn't quite get the non-materialistic part of psychedelics, or anything else about them either. Susan and Ray Davies were working on the upstairs of their house, which was nearing completion. Susan thought that she had some kind of respiratory bug, and had to take extra rest to be able to help with the work. Susan and Diane came to visit in late February, which was the last visit I had in Central Prison. Visits were very stressful to the guests, and none too easy on me either, but complete isolation was worse. The officials were on their best behavior with Diane, since she was a priest, while they were free to bully me in her absence. This gave her a rather different take on their attitude than I had. The reality was probably somewhere in between. After some months of incarceration, it was obvious to the officials that I was hardly a big threat to society or a hardened criminal. Susan continued to feel tired and shortly afterwards went to a doctor. He diagnosed leukemia, which shocked everyone. She underwent chemotherapy and after some very harrowing times went into remission, although remaining weak. She was the person most dear to me, and the thought of her suffering was almost intolerable. Two new white inmates came to my cell block. Michael Dial was about my age. He was physically strong, and his case had been in all the papers. As a result, other inmates shied away. I didn't read the papers and didn't much care what they wrote, having been covered by the Salisbury Post myself. Originally from Norfolk, Mike was facing a murder charge after his girlfriend's body washed up at Nag's Head in the Outer Banks without head or hands. We were both relieved to find someone intelligent to talk to, and we became close friends. At breakfast, we lined up small cartons of cornflakes and called ourselves the Serial Killers. He'd helped cheer me up when I was depressed, and I helped soothe his anger issues, which were formidable. The other inmate was Cale Buckner. A young buck in his early 20s from Gastonia, he was built like a fireplug and clearly had some wild living behind him. He also was facing a murder charge. We got along very well. For a little while, especially while both of them were in my cell block, I felt considerably more secure and had much fewer difficulties with blacks. But things were not exactly safe. Mike was sleeping out on the floor, waiting for a cell, when someone broke through the door separating our block from the next one that housed general population prisoners working in the kitchen. They invaded at night and beat the inmates who were sleeping outside cells. This was because they assumed safekeepers needed protection from other inmates. Therefore, there must be a reason they would be attacked. Therefore, they should be attacked when possible. That's logic for you. More depressing prison stories for your reading pleasure. When it warmed up enough to go to the exercise yard 1 hour a week, I got acquainted with Tom Bonney, who was about 60 years old. I didn't know about the details of his life until much later. He was pleasant and mild-mannered, in the way you would expect someone heavily medicated to be, which is to say, unbelievably spaced out. He had the appearance of someone not just harmless, but probably incapable of tying his own shoes, if he were allowed shoelaces. Before the unpleasantness that landed him here, he ran an auto recycling yard in Virginia. He'd been convicted of shooting his 19-year-old daughter 27 times for living with a man he didn't approve of and dumping her body in the Great Dismal Swamp Canal. There was a book and a movie out about his crime, both called Deadly Whispers. I have tried, quite unsuccessfully, to imagine Tony Danza playing Tom. After some years on death row, he was in safekeeping, pending a new sentencing hearing. Eventually, he was given life and went to general population. In 1994, Tom's mother died, and he couldn't go to the funeral. This made something snap even further in his head. He and a convicted rapist slid down a trash chute to the compactor. Tom broke his left arm and wrist and dislocated his shoulder, but that was getting off lightly. When the officials figured out where they'd gone, the assumption was that they were dead. The search was for two corpses down at the dump. Tom was rounded up a few days later under an I-64 overpass in Norfolk. Some days after that, they caught his partner in the mountains with a list of people he wanted to kill. One day, there was a fight on the long walk to lunch, and the lieutenant in charge of all us safekeepers broke it up. He was a short, powerfully built black man who, most of the time, was personable and professional. But not today. As he patted all of us down, he grabbed my penis and stroked it. I tore away from him as he laughed. He had absolute power over us and enjoyed the hell out of it. Pat Cole wrote from New Mexico. I had known the Coles well when I lived in Las Cruces. She was recovering from months of illness, and although an atheist, promised to write religiously. Her son Eric went schizophrenic, and his consequent dread of Satan worshippers caused him to attend the Jehovah's Witness Church. I resolved to visit them when possible. My paddling friend, Dr. Lou Candle, bought me a subscription to Wooden Boat magazine. I read there that Eric Stiller and Tony Brown were circumnavigating Antarctica in a double Klepper kayak. This was a typo. They meant Australia. Eric and I had debated gear choices at length in preparation for his trip, since I thought the BSD sails and outriggers were much superior to what he was going to use. They set out from Sydney and went up the east coast to Darwin. After a 2-day offshore crossing on the northern coast, they started to get worried at the prospect of 1,000 miles of 20-foot tides and 20-foot crocodiles. Tony split, and Eric got a bicycle and rode south through the center of Australia just for the hell of it. Oddly enough, I met a sailor in safekeeping. For some years, he'd shared ownership of a 45 or 50-foot keelboat and cruised to South America and back. He had great stories about his sailing adventures. Later, he went to trial, and I last saw him in the hall wearing gray, very heavily medicated. He and his wife both got 350 years for a string of rapes at Scissor Point throughout several southern states. On April 29th, riots broke out in South Central LA. The blacks on our block wished they could be there to enjoy the looting, burning, rape, and murder. If there were exceptions, I did not see them. It was astonishing to watch them cheer for days at the scenes of violence, especially the repeated video of Reginald Denny's beating with a concrete block to the head as he lay on the street. What hopes I had left for a healed and sane society free from racial divisions died that week. I corresponded with a couple of classical musicians living in Encinitas who felt much the same way. One day at Chow, we were joined at the serial killer's table by David Sokolowski. He was just there to stare vacantly into space, as he wasn't eating anything at the time. This is a dangerous policy, as hunger strikes count as damaging state property. They strap striking prisoners down and feed them by IV until they change their mind. David might have lost his appetite for good reason. His friend Rubel Hill and his girlfriend Pamela Elwood went missing in February. When the cops came by to check things out, they saw a bonfire in the backyard with a body in the flames. David kept parts in the fridge and evidently had eaten some of them. Somehow, even this wasn't enough for the death penalty, and he ended up with life. Not all the stories were grim. They brought in an inmate I'd known in the Salisbury jail, and I asked how he ended up here. Carefully. It's not good form to ask people what their crime was. He was quite jovial about it. He and his wife, along with some other friends, were in the jail on the same charge. His buddies figured out an escape plan, and they busted out together. He was trailing his friends as they ran out of the jail, holding a ring of keys, when one of the guards spotted what was happening and started shooting at the fleeing inmates. My friend decided that running across the parking lot, dodging bullets, was not a great idea, and he ducked into the only place available, the women's cell block. He unlocked the doors, locked them back, threw the keys into the hall, and hid in his wife's cell. They kept him hidden under a bunk for 3 weeks, until he was finally discovered. While visiting the doctor, I passed Bob Kelly in the hall. The news had been dominated since 1989 by the Little Rascals daycare case. By means of fabricated evidence and months of coercive treatment of children by therapists hired by the prosecution, Bob, his wife Betsy, and three others were accused of sexually abusing over 90 children. The testimony of the kids included trips to other planets and feeding them to sharks. But no matter, reality was not important. Bob was convicted on 99 out of 100 counts of child molestation and got 12 consecutive life terms. While usually child molesters get treated very badly, in this case, the inmates knew they were innocent. Due to nationwide publicity from PBS documentaries, the state was forced to drop all the charges in 1997. In the third week of July, without warning, I was moved to Hoke Correctional Institution out in the eastern flatlands. I think the administrators in Central Prison were trying to cut me a break, since the 10 safekeepers at Hoke were in less danger and in somewhat more relaxed and quieter conditions. We could go to the exercise yard an hour a day, had a little more room, and felt significantly less fear. Gary and Jim came to visit and took the only picture of me from between arrest and the summer of 1993. At first, I was pleased with my new location, but when I went to check in with the doctor's assistant on duty, things went downhill fast. I was dependent on naproxen and needed cortisone eye drops in case of a spell of iritis. After seeing my thick file, the nurse in charge scowled at me and said flat out, "We don't like sick people." the doctor's assistant canceled my prescriptions and gave me Advil, which was like using spitballs against a tank. I didn't know this until after our appointment, and could only make another appointment for his next weekly visit. In 2 or 3 days, I was in a great deal of pain and hardly able to walk, and started having another iritis attack. Turns out, all of Hoke County had only one doctor, since it's hard to convince any to come out and live in Tobacco Road country. We got the bottom of the barrel, a doctor who couldn't get employed anywhere else due to past convictions. When I complained to the administrators, they had heard all this before. One inmate was diabetic, and his first 2 days here, they withheld his insulin, giving in on the third day after they had heard enough of his yelling. It took 9 days for me to finally see the doctor. Far from restoring my medications, he threatened to send me back to the Salisbury jail and take my cane away. I was already holding onto the walls to get around. He also denied me sufficient bedding and thought I should be confined in such a way as to maximize my suffering. He accused me of trying to be comfortable. The non-medical staff was very understanding and cooperative, but there wasn't much they could do. A few days later, they sent me back to Central Prison. This set up a severe situation. I was put in a different cell block this time, and no longer had Mike and Cale around except during meals, when all the safekeepers ate together. I was back to sleeping on a bunk in the day room. Black inmates started severely hassling me for money, which was difficult since the prison took weeks to transfer my account of $53 from Hoke. I could not protect my belongings. Once again, my radio was stolen. Here, gambling was constant, unlike my old block where it was not tolerated. I remembered the good effects of our prayer circle and tried to start one up in the new block, but that was a huge mistake. I asked a black inmate named D.C. to join us, and he snarled a negative response. He was in for a double murder and had a long history of targeting white inmates who were either old or disabled for serious abuse. I saw a white man of about 70 who was terrified of him and seriously traumatized. Now he set his sights on me. He was part of a loosely formed gang headed by a Bloods gangster named King, who had been brought in by helicopter and SWAT teams a month or two previously. King was charged with 5 gang murders in the Durham area and wanted to be the top dog in safekeeping as well. I did my best to notify the authorities, and I asked to be locked down in protective custody. Instead, they moved me to my old cell block, which certainly helped. However, there were a couple of inmates on the block who were running with this gang and were keen to hurt me. Mealtime was the big danger. I walked to and from chow at the back of the line where an officer headed up the crowd and had Mike, Cale, and another white inmate box me in while I walked along the wall. With the danger so pressing, the officers in charge decided to send meals to my cell block so I wouldn't have to go through the hallway. I was so afraid at this point that it was difficult to eat as my hands shook severely and I could barely get food into my mouth. My radio had been stolen by DC, but I managed to buy it back from a third party. When the authorities heard of this, they threatened to charge me with an offense for buying stolen goods. In early September, I wrote to the sergeant pleading for protective custody, as my friends could no longer protect me. They also had been threatened with death. This was not an idle threat. 2 days before my letter, a man was rushed down the hall to the medical center with a slashed throat. DC demanded $15 as extortion. All this time, I had assured everyone that I had no intent of causing any harm or doing anything resulting in punishment, that I meant everyone the best. The gangsters found this completely confusing. After a few days of eating my cell block, the officers made me eat with the others again. The first meal, I got there safely, but for some reason the powers that be decided to escort me back to the block to eat there. when two officers escorted me out of the dining hall, nearly the whole crowd of 150 people suddenly erupted in jeers, taunts, and threats. I was frozen in fear as a bizarre carnival atmosphere surrounded me. The next meal I needed to complete in the dining hall. Without my white friends to help, I walked with a large black guy who volunteered to help me out. Suddenly I was confronted by 6 or 7 gang members, including King and DC. My friend said, "Step!" with a look of shock in his eyes, as he hadn't expected something to actually happen. We got away in the back of the crowd before I could be stabbed. That was the last time I saw my new friend. Finally, things calmed down. After all this senseless danger, they got the point that I was more trouble than anything they could get out of me. The administration at Central Prison was tired of having me around and wanted me to go to trial. Rick and Martha Denton came up from Atlanta to visit. They were very supportive and genuine friends throughout the ordeal.